This is Nightlife with James Findlay
on ABC Radio.
I want you to imagine relaxing by the pool in a lavish resort, cocktail in hand, palm trees everywhere. Real, like, White Lotus style travel. It sounds quite nice, doesn't it? It's this kind of luxury tourism that has been heavily promoted in many African countries like Botswana, Mauritius, and Rwanda. But what about the locals? How does the focus on luxury tourism affect the local economy? If you've been to these countries to holiday, I'd love to hear your experience. 1-300-800-222. Now, though, Dr. Pritish Birhuya is a scholar of political economy and development at the University of Manchester. He's been taking a look at this. Pritish, good evening or good day to you, and welcome to Nightlife.
Yeah, thanks, James. Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
How prevalent is this type of tourism in Africa? Paint us a bit of a picture here.
Well, it's not just Africa, really. There's been a push by the UN World Tourism Organization for several decades now to push this kind of luxury tourism around the world, especially in Africa and Asia to some degree. It started really picking up through Mauritius, and Mauritius is a big economic growth success story on the continent. It recently became a high-income country before dropping back to higher middle-income country after the pandemic. And then many countries after the 2000s have picked on Mauritius's example and tried to copy it, including Botswana, Rwanda, but it's not just these countries. It's also Seychelles and the Maldives and even Kenya and Tanzania have explored with these ideas as well.
Right. Okay. So when we say luxury, what kind of luxury are we talking here?
Yeah, I guess it's important to kind of distinguish. There are tourism protests all over the world right now because there's this idea in all kinds of tourism that it's not really helping the economy. Luxury tourism is really based on this simple idea that if you attract fewer tourists to the country who spend more money per day, it'll have less negative effects on the environment and also for the broader population. Now, in reality, it doesn't turn out like that. When you visualize it, of course, it's all-inclusive resorts. It's all-inclusive resorts and safaris and beaches, etc. And the idea is that they probably touch the economy even less than more widespread tourism. But this, the basic idea that luxury tourism doesn't have a big environmental effect is also wrong because, of course, we know from a lot of press that the luxury tourists actually spend more money on private jets and other things as well. I mean, have a bigger ecological impact through private jets and the way they travel.
Right. Okay. So why is this being promoted as a good economic strategy, and who's pushing that idea?
It's a very attractive idea when it's sold with the fact that it may reduce ecological impacts and it may actually have a less negative impact. Also, many of these countries are really starved of exports. They export very few commodities and they don't have enough foreign exchange. So since they import more than they export, they run out of foreign exchange a lot. So their economy is quite weak. So tourism and luxury tourism really is quite attractive and has this allure for these economies. Okay. And who would benefit? Go on.
Yeah, no, so when we're thinking like luxury though, so you know, you mentioned all inclusive resorts, but like what kind of like we're talking like real high end kind of luxury, right?
I mean, there's the 5-star hotels, of course, but really the I guess an emblematic kind of way of thinking about luxury tourism is these all inclusive packages, right? Now these are booked by travel agents outside the country. They're usually in the largest 5-star resorts within the country, which are usually foreign owned or owned by the largest company in the country. And they often employ workers as well outside the country. And they use imported goods because they have to meet the luxury standards.
Oh.
So it's really very, they barely touch the economy. So those kind of all-inclusive package deals at 5-star resorts, that's the most luxury kind of way of thinking about this.
Wow. Okay. And what clients are being targeted for these kind of holidays and getaways?
Well, usually, and it has been like this for the last two decades, really, it's been targeted at European countries, European and North America, really. And that is primarily the way large groups of tourists have traveled to Botswana, to Mauritius, to and even now to Rwanda and other countries in Africa, including Kenya and Tanzania, etc.
Okay.
And they, yeah, and that's been criticized heavily within country because basically a lot of the revenues don't really touch the economy.
Dr. Pritish Bihuria is with you. He's the a scholar of political economy and development at the University of Manchester here on Nightlife on ABC Radio. And you're hearing about, well, tourism, luxury tourism in Africa, but also other parts of the world, but mostly Africa, and whether these luxury resorts and these kind of holiday deals are actually helping the economy there. I'd love to hear your experience if you've been and seen this firsthand, 1-300-800-222. Let's take a look at some of your research, Pritish. There's, let's go to Mauritius first. They seem like one of the first to go down the path. How did that come about and how successful has it been?
So Mauritius is a very tiny island off the coast of Africa, and it has always been a very unequal country. Basically, they're a small French settler population, French Mauritian settler population, has historically owned most of the land around the coast. Now, Mauritius at independence in the 1960s didn't produce or export very much. They had sugar basically, and they exported sugar. So the new government, which was mostly of Asian descent, I mean, the population, and then is mostly Creole South Asian descent, about 70%. There's a small European settler population of about 10%. And then there's a small Creole population within the continent as well. Within the country as well. Now, this French settler population pushed the tourism strategy, but they did it in a way that they could still control 88% of the coastal land, and that's where they built the largest resort. In many ways, this was a huge success. It created enormous tourism revenues, but until very recently, there was no attempt to change it. But after COVID-19, because tourism arrivals dropped to zero, the Mauritius government use this as an opportunity to diversify the strategy more. And rather than simply focusing on European or North American tourists, now they're really broadening their strategy to attract more Asian tourists, etc., and build up non-luxury destinations where even other businesses, smaller businesses, can set up smaller hotels that may actually thrive in that kind of a more open tourism sector.
Right. Okay. And that sounds like that it might be able to will help more local people. Is that what we're what you saw?
That's the hope, and that a lot of this has happened because the presiding Mauritius government then was weakening, and there was in the face of a high amount of inequality and inability to create jobs, they were able to reverse the strategy to a degree. A country that hasn't been able to do this is Rwanda. And Rwanda is one of the fastest growing countries really in the world. It's, again, a very small country in the middle of the continent. But it's prioritized luxury tourism at all costs. And there has been, the president of the country has ruled now since 2000 formally, but has been in power since 1994. And there has been a real push towards luxury tourism at all costs, but they have not shifted their strategy. And it shows you in a way that actually a weak party is in power, they may be able to respond much more to the population's needs than a more, authoritarian country or a single party that has dominant control over the country.
Right. Okay. And so have we seen any effects of this yet?
In Mauritius? It's too early to say. There's more tourism, more tourists coming from a wider variety of countries because the policies have only been in place for 1 or 2 years. But there's definitely less dissent towards the tourism sector than there was, especially during COVID-19 and right before it. In Botswana, it became a huge political issue, and a long-standing president, Ian Khama, whose father was also president of the country, had been pushing for luxury tourism to a great degree for about a decade. But the two successive presidents afterwards have now diversified their focus. You can already see changes in terms of employment and bringing in a wider range of tourists, etc., that are appeasing the population a bit more.
Mm. I'd love to hear your experience on this. 1-300-800-222. Let's go to Matt, who's in Perth. Matt, you went on a holiday to Mauritius. What did you see?
It was right way. Half I stayed in someone's house and the other half was in a five-star resort to have a bit of a luxury treat. All of the staff in the resort were locals, even up to the management. The management would come around and have a chat and give recommendations of places to see in the local villages, along with the wait staff. So good interaction there. They had people from the local towns coming in, teaching you to cook the local food. And even when we went out to the supermarket to get some sunscreen and that, we actually saw the staff from the hotel buying food for the cooking out there. One thing that really surprised me was we're expecting to sit on the beach and see everyone. You know, the beach was going to be packed because the place was fully booked, and yet no one was out on the beach.
Where were they?
Well, I would guess you go out to the museums and the botanical gardens and, you know, the volcanoes, and that's where everyone is.
Huh.
And I think the merchants have got it quite right, where locals get in for free or at a minimal charge, and it's sometimes up to 30 times more expensive for a ticket for tourists to go into museums because you can afford it. So it's quite different to what we're hearing here.
Did you have a good time?
Awesome time. Beautiful people, beautiful food, great location.
Yeah, right. And would you go again?
I enjoyed it, but I'd probably try somewhere different because I like going to
different places.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks heaps for the call, Matt.
No worries.
Matt in Perth there, 1-300-800-222 is the number called. Love to hear your experience on this here on Nightlife on ABC Radio. You're hearing about the luxury tourism industry in parts of Africa. Dr. Pritish Brahiria is with you from the University of Manchester. Pritish, what's your response to what Our caller Matt there had to see when he went to Mauritius.
Yeah, I think one of the points he raises, of course, is that the beaches were empty, right? And that's because actually the local population cannot access those private beaches. They can only access 12% of the beach property in the country. Wow. And that's public beach time. So that kind of explains, and really, like, a lot of the beaches are exclusive to certain resorts. So it's not even other tourists, or you can pay at a fee, of course. So that visually within the country has given tourism kind of bad name historically, right? But of course, I think there are certain hotels that try to build in the economy more, and they do use local goods to some degree, right? But they also import a huge amount of goods because they have to meet the standards that are set to be called a five-star, to be certified for the different kinds of regulations.
Mm.
So there are these inequalities built in within the system. But of course, some certain hotels may be doing a bit better in terms of redistribution than others.
Matt mentioned there that he found that there were many locals that were employed at the luxury resort. What have you found in regards to not just how many are employed, but maybe their rates of pay as well?
So in Mauritius, there's been the luxury tourism strategy has been in place for about 3 decades now. So there are more Mauritians employed at different levels of the tourism sector. In Rwanda, it's much less. Basically, even until about 5 or 6 years ago, all the managers were from neighboring countries, including Kenya and Tanzania. But that training was taking place. They had several tourism colleges that were established. But it does take some time. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge with tourism globally is it's usually kind of low-paid, informal work. Some people maybe formally employed at hotels, but it's generally quite insecure. And of course, if tourism drops, they lose their jobs, right? But there's one thing about being employed by the hotels, but the whole service economy that's developed is very precarious. In Mauritius, for example, a large share of the population is employed in services work for the tourists coming into the country. That is taxi drivers, that is tour guides, etc., which is both competitive in terms of getting that work from those tourists, and it's not really something that can be relied upon. Luckily, Mauritius has a large welfare state, and it's been able to cater to its population for some time, despite not being able to create much employment. But most other countries in Africa don't have that kind of welfare state.
Let's go back to Botswana. You mentioned it earlier there. And I think this is an example of maybe what's best for your local kind of country as opposed to what's best for tourism, where they had a hunting ban in place for quite a while, but then had that reversed.
Yeah, it's quite controversial in many ways because a hunting ban, the idea that groups of tourists are coming for trophy hunting, there are many reasons to be against this. I think many people normatively would disagree with this, including me. But a more enclave or more even a more unequal strategy is simply in terms of protecting and conservation at a very extreme degree. Now, Botswana has an overpopulation of elephants, and you cannot kill an elephant at least till 2020, even as a local. And in fact, there were many incidents of elephants killing people as a result. And that was to protect the conservation element, to protect this kind of luxury photographic tourism element. Now, that was done under the president, Ian Khama, to push this. And actually, Ian Khama was alleged to have ownership of many of the photography and tourism companies that were benefiting from that kind of tourism. Now, when his successor came to power, he reversed the hunting ban. Now, of course, this isn't to simply kill a lot of elephants. It's about managing the population that can also have some degree of redistributive benefits for the population. And that was reversed in the 2020s. And there's actually no push actually now to bring back the hunting ban in a big way.
Really? They don't want to bring it back?
No. Because it's, I mean, it was a real problem. I mean, in terms of the overpopulation of the elephants, and it was extremely unequal. It was a lot of communities were benefiting to some degree from the hunting. It's really hard to think about because, I mean, normatively you would be against, I mean, I would be against hunting, but it was having this very negative impact on the population.
Gosh, it's funny that you know, thinking that there might be too many elephants somewhere, you know, when we're hearing about elephant populations around the world that are endangered, you know? Okay, let's go to Rwanda then. You've also done research at Rwanda. What role does tourism play there?
Well, so Rwanda, as I mentioned, is a very small country. It doesn't export a lot of products. So it has traditionally been primarily reliant on coffee for 70% of its exports. Since the new government came to power in 1994, after the genocide, they really prioritized diversifying the economy. So that's including other agricultural products. But tourism has been the centerpiece of the economy because they're a landlocked country in the middle of the continent. So they couldn't really develop at a competitive way manufacturing or other kind of sectors because of the high transport costs. So they decided that they wanted to make their landlocked real geographical vulnerability into a kind of land-linked land-linked possibility for becoming a hub for the region, including a tourism hub for the region. So they invested in their airline quite significantly, which has created a huge amount of debt, actually, Rwandair. And they decided that they're going to build attract luxury tourists in a big way. So they've started holding sporting events. They had the World Championships of Cycling there. They host the NBA Africa there. They've had a few FIFA events as well. And they built a large conference center, and they hold a huge amount of conferences, including UN events. So this brings in business tourists who, in theory, spend more per day than your average backpacker.
Yeah, wow.
So it has been, and they are one of the most active and fastest growing countries in the world. But as a result, because tourism is doesn't create enough jobs, and because they've really incentivized Hyatt and Marriott and other big hotel brand names to come, they have neither been able to really support domestic businesses within the country or really create enough formal sector employment in tourism. And this really hit them hard during COVID-19, when, of course, tourist arrivals plummeted to basically zero.
Yeah.
Now they're rebuilding the sector, but they're not shifting the luxury tourism part.
Right. So when countries do lean into this luxury tourism thing, like you've mentioned a bit, you know, a lot of product is brought in, where does all the money go when these tourists spend it, particularly if they're spending it just at one of those all-inclusive resorts?
Exactly. So often the travel agents that book it are outside the country, so it never touches the economy, right? So the package, usually, at least in all three of these countries, most of the bookings are done by travel agents outside the country. Mm-hmm. The money that they do spend in terms of buying goods, of course, they go to the businesses that they buy goods from. And the hotels, they go to the hotel, hotel owners, but who are off, at least in Rwanda, they are the largest, a lot of the largest hotels are foreign owned.
Right. So gosh, so if the hotels are foreign owned, the lot of the product, or some of the product at least, is being brought in, it sounds like, you know, a very, like, a small percentage of the money will actually stay in the country.
Absolutely. A very small percentage of the money will actually stay in the country.
What effect does that have on countries when the tourism is when very little amount of the tourism money is staying there, but they're, I guess, I don't want to use the word exploitation, but is there an exploitation of the country when this happens?
In a way, you could say that, really. And I think what's crucial here, because obviously it's not the picture that we painted just now is a very extreme picture. Now, to some degree, governments have tried to counter this exploitation. But they've done this in a way to either take on some ownership of, you know, booking the travel themselves, or, I mean, through government companies or through domestic companies, or through building up their own domestic hotels to some degree.
Right. Or, well, I don't know. Really? I think there are European countries that have implemented like a tourism tax kind of thing. Is that something that they might look at?
Yeah, so that's not really happened as yet. So I think that could happen, but the problem with that is it kind of edges out the it just makes it more luxury to some degree, right? Because other people can't spend it.
Yeah,
I don't think it's not really about not having any luxury tourism. It's about having a more diversified kind of tourism base, so it can more broadly affect the economy, and that creates more. But the challenge with this is really difficult, because if you have a more open tourism sector, it's not going to be luxury, because luxury is something only a few people can access. So how do you even maintain that luxury status while also opening up? So the countries are really caught in a difficult position in a way.
So if someone's thinking about going to one of these countries for a nice holiday, what can travelers think about when going there? What's an ethical way to go about holidaying in some of these countries that don't usually get a lot of tourists?
I think being more conscious about everyone should continue to go for tourism, but try to buy more locally, eat more locally at restaurants. Be aware, or maybe discuss, how the redistributive elements of the tourism strategy are developing, because a lot of the communities within tourism areas, say in safari areas, they are lobbying for more a better redistribution of benefits within the sector. So seeing how you may be able to augment their voice during your tourism trip, that could be perhaps the most beneficial way.
Look, Pritish, it's been really enlightening and insightful to have a chat with you tonight. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, James. It's been a real pleasure for me as well. Thanks so much.
This is Nightlife with James Finlay on ABC Radio.